Welcome to Stafford Unplugged. The objective of this podcast is to surface a casual conversation between me and a human being that is generally not accessible to the public, to ask them simple layman questions and hear their mesmerizing answers. I hear incredible posits and angles to things and ideas that most people don't think of. These are captains of industries. These are mesmerizing orators. These are visionaries. And the objective of this podcast is to allow you to hear some of their views regarding some of the most topical things that you and I are thinking about. Casual conversations. I'm lucky enough to have access to them. And the opportunity that you have right now is to listen in on that conversation. Do we cover everything in depth? No. Do we go back and forth? Yes. Just simply listen in to a conversation that I have with some of my friends and listening to their incredible minds. Completely unplugged. Enjoy. Okay, Scott, this is a privilege and a pleasure, man. It's been, I don't know, the last time I saw you, I think it was when Lisa and I went out to the States, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. We just went to go visit Utah, and then we popped over into a cafe down in Heber somewhere, and then we shot down to Vegas from there. How you been?
I've been well. Been having fun and just still doing kind of the same stuff I've been doing for years.
Scott, when I met you when I moved to the States, I think it was 1996 or 1997. I don't know if you know that. That was the first time I met you. And back then, you were one of those guys in Novell that were one of the leading minds. You were always looking at stuff way beyond where the current engineers were developing. And you always used to walk in the room. And when Scott walked in the room, it was, okay, what is Scott going to tell us today? It was like, what's coming, etc. Just take us back there. What was your role back then?
Back then, you know, I went in and out of Novell, four times. Like at that point, possibly working, I don't know, was I working for Duck Knight at that time as a corporate integration manager or something like that?
You were, I'll tell you what you were. You were a CTS, corporate technology strategist. That's what they called you. We were called global corporate technology strategist. So, no, you were global CTSs. We were something else. I can't remember.
All I know is I got to have the most fun, you know, that I probably ever had in my life. You know, the company had such amazing, brilliant people. And I remember that when I started with Novell, I was working as an SE in the field. I got taken to corporate eventually as a product manager, became a product specialist, and started to do, you know, various executive briefings and domestic U.S. presentations at a lot of conferences and meetings, and just learn how people were using technology. And then I remember this breakthrough moment when I was talking with some of the guys in international sales over lunch one day, and they said, you know, when you get tired of this domestic thing, let us know, because we'll let you travel international. And, you know, that was just the most amazing, you know, experience of my life, to get to travel the world speaking about technology and learning what customers do, and also seeing that gap, that difference between what was being done in the US domestically and then what was being done in international countries. I mean, I remember, you know, being in Pakistan at one point talking to the military, where they were talking about building networks in the jungles and the, you know, far reaches of Pakistan, where they had people hired to run spools of cable through the jungle to string networks. You know, it was an incredible time when all that was building out.
I remember there was something that you did in particular, and I think it was you and Bobby did it. I think you set up the first Wi-Fi network that I think the first Wi-Fi network I ever connected to in my entire life. And where we had the SD cards plugged in, and I think it was 802.11x cards, and we connected over Wi-Fi, was at a brain share. And I think you and Bobby Russell actually set that up. Was it you set it up?
That was actually mine. You know, right? I had gone to Comdex the year before and gone to the Zircom booth, and Zircom was showing these wireless network adapters. They were the PCMCIA cards. Yep.
With their little red end.
Some of the original Zircom, they had this dinky little antenna thing, and it was all non-standard. And I was just amazed, you know. And I remember coming back and telling people, and people thought I was crazy. You know, they just said, what the heck? You think people are going to connect over this instead of Ethernet? You know, Ethernet's going to be 100 megabit pretty soon. And like, why would you ever do it? And And, you know, it was a year later, I stayed in touch with those people and they spun out of Zircon, were sold off. Again, the market just hadn't taken off and became a company called NetWave Wireless. And as BrainShare was coming and I was dealing with the guys at NetWave and started to see what was happening in the standards. And back then, like 802.11 wasn't even ratified at that point. Talked Drew Major into funding. So Drew, the chief scientist at Novell, and he funded the project. And so, yeah, for BrainShare, at that time, that would have been 1998, we put together basically the largest, you know, wireless-enabled conference that had ever been held. We had about, you know, equivalent of like five city blocks. Yeah. And that we had covered one hotel lobby and then the whole conference floor, the meeting rooms. And I think there were about 400 adapters. What I loved, one of the best stories I have about that was the metadata that you were able to see. I don't know if you remember, but we had Novell's Border Manager, which was like a SQUID proxy server.
Yes, and we
were funneling all the traffic through it. And during the keynotes, I could actually monitor the traffic. So I created a little chart that I was holding backstage in real time that was a boredom detector. Because as the different people would speak, you could watch as like the traffic would go up and it's like, oh, they're getting boring. But then when they got to talk about something exciting, all the traffic would drop off.
That's insane. That is insane. I still remember you guys running around laying cable for that with the base stations and checking signal strength and running from one room to the other and the other before the conference started. I look back at my time and I obviously had a discussion with JD Merrimy a couple of weeks ago. And it's actually fascinating to see that we were on the cusp back then of so many things. I mean, directory services, very few people spoke about back then. We were, you know, Wi-Fi networks. Drew was doing things with file systems and demonstrating it to us that no one else could do and no one else was even thinking of. It was just everything of digital me. I remember you were one of the minds behind digital me, right? What was the thinking there? Because I asked JD and he flagged over it a bit, but I remember that you were intricately involved there with a few people in there. But I remember you telling me about digital me and the concept of it over in the cafeteria one day. I sat and I was just listening to you speaking about digital me. And today, digital me is still new.
Yeah.
It's still not done. There's still such a need for it. But just take me back to that digital me.
You know, I always tend to get pretty philosophical about technology and looking at what has it work and not work. And, you know, we were doing the directory back then. And, you know, a directory service was designed to allow users to be created in a single directory and then be given rights to assets or resources within company networks. So could you access certain files? Could you access printers? And the directory also had the ability to attribute a person, you know, so you had not only these rights, but information about yourself, your name, your position in the company, and it was extensible. So you could continue to add attributes. And at that time, you know, I started to really be thinking philosophically about, you know, identity on the internet and started to think about, you know, the inefficiencies we have in systems and they still exist today. You know, we don't have a good solution for exchanging business cards. You know, I meet you in a place and to exchange that business card, you know, is still a paper card. There isn't some transparent thing that has replaced that. Likewise, you know, if I go to fill out a job application or even more importantly, like a rental or a lease agreement, you know, you get an agreement that still might be a paper form or online that asks you for the same information. And if you're, you know, trying to rent a place and you're going to apply at five different apartment complexes or, condos, whatever it is, you've got to fill that out multiple times. And as I thought about that exchange of information and thinking about the directory, one of the things that hit was one day working with a group in our India Development Center. And they had taken the directory service and created a port of it that they called personal directory. And it was something that could run on your machine. And to me, that was the most incredible, brilliant thing, which was to invert the model of instead of saying you're a part of a giant corporate directory, that you also might have a personal directory where you could accumulate your physical, you know, your identity, your components of your identity, you could accumulate that and use that as a mechanism to share data with other people. And that's kind of what kicked that idea off. And I firmly believe that that's a more natural system of biological people, that of how we exchange identity. You know, we pick and choose what we share with each other. We pick and choose the truthfulness of what we share with each other. We pick contexts that we share with each other. And so that began some of this idea of digital me, which was, how do I accumulate my identity over time? And I remember saying back then to Eric Schmidt and to Mike Sheridan, like, a real win to me would be, are you the first directory a child gets, you know, when they are born, that they begin to accumulate their life identity information, and that they can automate and create rules on how they share and synchronize that information with other people. And that sort of was that foundation of digital me.
Yeah. And the fact is that on the internet today, it's actually accelerated the overall problem that we identified back then, because it's still a problem today, right? Now, what's your thoughts on blockchain and a ledger and some type of federated ledger that's decentralized, that does all of this stuff? Is that the beginning, potentially, maybe something that's off-chain?
Yeah, that deals with, you know, first, I mean, I think blockchain is amazing. You know, I truly, the fundamental technology and the mathematical problems that were solved in the creation of blockchain and demonstrated with Bitcoin, you know, are just phenomenal. You know, it really is an amazing technology. I do think that it's a hammer that's being applied to everything, you know, all over the place. In a lot of places, it doesn't make sense and it's unnecessary. There is a group out there. There's a project called Sovryn. I think it's SOVRYN or something like that.
That guy actually, he's at BYU, the head of Sovryn. He's actually a professor
chairman of Sovryn, and that is kind of the direction they're going, which goes back to, you know, and he and I have talked about this for years, even in personal directory. I'll still posit that you have no inherent identity at all, that all identity is given to you by observers or by companies or organizations. Like, your passport is given to you, your driver's license is given to you, even your height and weight. Like, they don't exist outside the context of a community of people that agree on what those measurements mean. So all your identity is something you gain. And that's one of the things that Personal Directory and Digital Me was after, and what we were trying to accomplish with that. And Sovryn is doing the same thing, which is using blockchain as a definitive set of pointers to your identity with other, and I forget what they call them, but it's, you know, custodians of that identity. Yes, or something like that. So that, you know, your driver's license is not stored in the blockchain. It's a reference to who is the entity that can verify your driver's license, you know, things like that. And so I think there's some possible value there. But at the same time, I've got this belief of there can never be one, right? So Sovryn would be one possible source of identity, just like today. You know, we all have identity that we've collected from different organizations and groups. That's why in the end, it seems like it comes back to us being the real focal point of our identity.
You know what? I've been thinking about this myself, because I haven't found anything outside of Bitcoin where blockchain's applicable, or I'm still yet to find a project. And I hear these guys investing tons of money, and I just smile, because I've been there, I've seen it, you know, just slap a database with some web services around that thing, and it's going to be so much better than getting this database to just replicate every single thing every time someone just touches it. It just doesn't make sense. But this could be a segue into where you are today in the IoT world. There's something that I said the other day, and I'd like to hear your view on it. I said, you know, Bitcoin blockchain is to me the only decentralized mechanism or derivative of blockchain. And I think that's what the beauty of it is. It was like open source software. It was the notion of that true decentralization actually coming to the fore. And that magic, you can't technologically just replicate that magic. That's a magic that makes Bitcoin blockchain work. That's what makes open source software work, is that true wisdom of crowds, that true mechanism of aggregating all of that input. Now, if you had to take a look at where this is going. So again, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist, right? I believe in Bitcoin. I don't believe in all the other alt stuff. But I think Bitcoin, as a medium of exchange, there's two elements I see to it. I see, number one, it is applicable to a group of people that's completely unaddressed in the world today. Like if you walk around in Africa, there are so many people that deal in cash, and that's the informal economy. But I feel there's a third economy. Like you get the formal economy, which is you and I, we got cards, we got, I know you've always dealt in cash though. I remember that you never wanted to have a card and someone tracking you. But I mean, you forget the formal economy and then you get the informal economy, which is cash. And that's very, actually quite sophisticated. And in most markets in the world, the informal economy, cash is actually bigger than the digital, you know, formal economy. But there's still the biggest one is the unaddressed one. It's the guy that lives 2 to 3 hours outside of Shenzhen. He doesn't have access to cash unless it's through a mafia system or syndicate. But if he could get his hands on a platform that enabled him to create financial, you know, systems and platforms and instruments, he could create a whole new class utilizing things like Bitcoin. And so that's the one aspect. The other aspect that I believe is IoT. I think Bitcoin and the ledger and everything underneath it could be an incredible thing that allows a ratchet, a platform for machine to machine value of exchange with no human interaction, where like you bring IoT and Bitcoin together and suddenly you create a value exchange between machines and devices and peripherals and sensors. And that takes IoT kind of to its next level because it still kind of needs human beings involved in it, where machines. But what if something could exchange value with something else contextually relative to moisture, relative to, you know, whatever the sensor may be saying?
So it's funny. There's a couple things I want to back up on. One, which is Bitcoin. You know, I did the typical when Bitcoin first came out. I was mining it, and of course, at some point, got bored with it, and that hard drive is gone. So I don't even know how much I lost, you know, and where it went. But then I got into it again when it sort of picked up again, and I started mining pretty heavily and you know, actually made some pretty good Bitcoin out of that. I agree with you. The altcoins are just insanity. You know, I have yet to really see one that makes sense to be anything. But my real moment that hit on what you were talking about was that at one point I tracked down the guy who had created the ant miners because I wanted to get these ant miners. And he was on some of the forums, but very difficult to track down. And of course, if you remember, you know, our knowledge of the internet and everything else, it was actually through some links to domain names that I picked him up and found him, had a friend in China, and we called the registered phone number and it ended up being his cell phone. And he was like blown away at how did you get a hold of me? How did you get this number? And so, you know, I'm going through a translator and we're kind of talking. And I told him, you know, I want to buy these ant miners. And he said, okay, you know, how many do you want? And, you know, we talked about price through the translator. And he said, okay, I'll get back to you. And it blew my mind that like 2 weeks later, 40 ant miners like show up on a pallet at my house in Utah with no money up front or anything. Like he just shipped them to me. And I started to sell ant miners. And as I would actually set them up to burn them in, right? And run them online. Right, and then as people would buy them, I'd pack them up and ship them. And I remember the very first time I did this transaction where I called and said, okay, I'm going to need some more. And he said, okay, well, how much, you know, here's my address. And I sat there and transferred Bitcoin to him in China, not knowing who he was, where he was. And within that first minute, he said, okay, yep, got it. And that was it. Like no third party, no bank involved, no wire company involved. And this is in the tens of thousands of dollars that, you know, I just did a transfer. And that was just so eye-opening, right? So that is that first part that like hit me of, yeah, what you're saying, this other economy and this ability to exchange money without anybody else involved was just kind of crazy. When you get to the IoT thing, you know, I think that, yeah, your statement gets really interesting and compelling, you know, not even for, well, I'm trying to think of how I would describe this, but yeah, I think it is interesting to think about how the exchange of value could be done without humans in the loop. And I know that from my history and, you know, from some of the things I've said in the past that, you know, I do believe that we are slowly evolving the internet more and more to remove humans from the loop. Now, to me, that doesn't mean that you get rid of humans and humans are going to be wiped out and that the machines take over. I don't believe that philosophically, but I do believe that for the efficiency of the systems that are going to be controlling the environment around us, potentially using something like blockchain as a mechanism for, you know, sensors and applications that need access to data to be able to exchange value, you know, using something like that makes perfect sense.
Ah, so yeah. I'm not too far off. Because I said that on stage the other day, and it was actually one of those stage moments where I thought, I answered, it was a big audience. I think it was 800 people, yeah. And there was Q&A. And I had that epiphany on stage that my IoT could completely take the next level if you started incorporating value exchange. Because human-to-human value exchange, it is magical. Absolutely, right? But it's skeuomorphic thinking that that's what Bitcoin, maybe Bitcoin was actually built for when a sensor speaks to another sensor and the two processors identify something algorithmically and says, okay, I need to exchange this value. For you to get what I can give you or do what I need you to do, I need to compensate you or you need to be compensated.
So think about this in a slightly different context. And this, again, is something, you know, I love to do as I speak and talk to people to try and prod them to think differently is, you know, this is why I talk about the internet the way I do, is to me, the IoT, the interesting part of the IoT is that it's removing humans from the loop. You know, we have been these primary interfaces to the internet, humans entering data using websites and forms and reading data and then interacting over phones. So, you know, the more you could remove that, it's kind of interesting. But the other way to think about IoT and the internet is that the IoT is giving the internet this ability to feel and interact with the physical planet. You know, if you think of the internet as a growing entity in itself that has some sort of, you know, I don't want to say consciousness, but life in the applications and the things that are running there, those applications and next generation applications need access to physical world data in order to often do what they're going to do. And today, there is no exchange of value for that. Like a trivial example would be if you open Google Maps and you go to a store that you're going to go visit and you pop open that store in Google Maps, they give you an indication of here are the hours they're open and here's how busy that store is at a relative level. Now, how did they do that? Well, they did that because they're picking up anonymous GPS data from cell phones that are located at that store. Right. So Google is harvesting that information and saying for their application, you know, to provide that capability, there's this data that's coming from cell phones. And since they know they're all clustered there, they can tell, are there more than usual there? Or
well, that this is for Waze. This is for Google traffic.
But if it was a third party application that now wants that data, how does it get access? How does it? There's a couple of things that still have not been solved in IoT. One, where is the directory of available possible sensors? So where is the registry of sensors? And there might not be just one.
You know what? Sometimes you say stuff and I get goosebumps. Like I just that one gives me goosebumps. Like that where is the DNS for IoT?
If I wanted access to temperature data where you are right now, how can I locate a sensor that's near you that could provide me that data? There has to be some mechanism that sensors can say, here's where I am and what I am and what kind of data I can provide, the resolution of the data, the accuracy of the data, all that kind of stuff. And then there are applications out there that are going to want data. And what's interesting about your statement that I hadn't kind of thought before is, you know, blockchain or a digital currency like that does become an interesting way for the application to say, well, I want data from this group of sensors. Those sensors can say, I can provide it for these micropayments to you as an application. And at that point, you now have this transaction that could be set up and actually occur.
Yeah. And I think that's where, because as soon as you do transaction enablement, there's an element of trust and validity and reputability, right? So repudiation is always that big challenge when you're federating identity and you're worried. And I think if you add the ledger and you add a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and you bring this IoT thing in, I think I love the DNS of IoT. I love that. I think that is so, so needed. Coming back to kind of the philosophy of a lot of the things, and that's why a lot of what you say resonates. And every time I listen to you, I think, yeah, because I get the meaning, yeah. Right? Not what it is, but it's like, what's the meaning of this? And one of the things about the internet, and I came up with this thing, I call it Smurfs. Someone said, what do you think the internet is? And I said, I think it's Smurfs. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, it's a sensory membrane of ubiquitous real-time federated yeah. subsystems, right? The acronym is Smurfs. I mean, it's all about building a skin layer to the internet. The internet is actually mm-hmm. developing an epidermis where it's feeling and we constantly, and the new UI, which is so amazing to me when I watched all these, and I want to get your take on them, is as people say, what's the next user interface of the internet? I think there is no user interface. I think it's sensor driven, right? It's not you walking in the room and opening up your phone and accessing Uber as an app. It's you saying Uber. And, you know, Alexa goes off and gets you the Uber and it says this person, this name is 3 minutes away and you jump in and you're speaking to the guy and he takes you from point A to B and you jump out, say cheers and you walk away. And there was never an application accessed by a human. There was never you opening up a website or paying in a weird way with a QR code. None of that. Like it almost feels like everything about the internet is its dissipation. Like the future of it is that when it disappears, it becomes prolific. When it becomes a consequential execution by inference that's relevant, you know, yeah. contextual, then the magic happens. But like the more we interact with it, the dumber it is. It's almost like when humans need to do so many things, not because of the tech, but because they are so slow. Like the tech can do it itself. What's your thoughts on that?
So it's funny. I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you completely. And it takes me back to even, you know, digital me and personal directory. You know, I think that the way that begins to occur is, you know, by initial interactions that you do that should be learned from. If you always tip at a certain amount, at a certain point, the tipping could become automatic. Because you assume, you know, that you're going to tip a certain amount. So that Uber driver drives you somewhere. You're going to pay. You're going to pay with a particular card. You should only be prompted on the exception, not the norm, right? So like you're saying, you know, if yeah. you're asking for an Uber, you might be asked what the address is. And at the point, then you're sort of told that, you know, okay, he's almost here and now it's there. You get in the car. When you get out, the payment should just occur and it should provide the tip that you normally give. You know, only if there was some exception, you know, something should change. I do agree that, you know, a lot of this could be automated. And when we were looking at digital me, we were saying, well, you know, if I'm going to give you my quote business card, the moment I give it to you, I should be asked, well, do you just want to keep Stafford up to date with all this information for the rest of time? And so that if I change my phone number or I change my address, the system should just notify you. And it doesn't even have to notify you. It should just update your copy so that the next time you say call Scott, it just calls the phone number or it uses even now. I mean, that's a sort of a silly analogy is why do we keep using phone numbers? And I think you had that conversation with JD, but it should just contact me via my preferred contact mechanism. Right. It's those kind of things. And yeah, I agree with that. And I also agree with your idea of this sort of meta subsystems that we're creating in the internet. You know, everybody wants to talk about AI and we all want to talk about it as though it's something that will run in a machine. And I think it's kind of silly. You know, I think that it's going to be this massive interactive set of applications in the cloud, out there somewhere that gains consciousness or becomes that next thing, not an application that we run in one or two machines. You know, it really is being built piece by piece and we're linking it all together. And, you know, it's going to be operating at a very different level than us.
That's, you know, I'm so glad you say that. Again, another goosebump moment because it just validates a lot of my thinking around AI. I mean, people have said, okay, so what do you think AI is and what's the future of AI? I wanted to pose that question to you. And what I've been saying to people is it is not Go, you know, AlphaGo over there, you know, beating the best Go player. It's not Watson disseminating radiological information. It's not Kasparov being beaten by Blue. That is an AI. But when you truly speak about AI, you're actually speaking about disparate species of cognition, you know, that come together in a way that's completely unpredicted, but yet when it does happen, so obvious. And it's not a story that is a GPUs within a corporation or a data center. It's actually human beings augmented by disparate species of AIs that come together and they like do something incredible. I mean, Tim O'Reilly says it so beautifully. He says, stop thinking about making your company a platform only. He says, you know, make it an algorithmic marketplace. An algorithmic marketplace is a place where it is human machine symbiosis, the driver, the car, the person with the phone and, you know, and themselves. And then there's this big data lake shore that crunches all that stuff, but there's so much real time stuff happening there. And that's why search pricing goes up and down. It's actually something that says, hey, amount of people that's going to ask for rides versus the density of cabs in proximity. And as soon as those cabs get notified that the rides are going to, hey, it's going to give you more, they start their engines and then it's the surge pricing settles back down again. That's not a platform, right? Yeah. That, to me, that's AI. That's an algorithmic marketplace. It's not a you know, big thing crunching big numbers. And I always think people, well, I hear people talk about AI. Let's buy GPUs. And let's just, you know, create data lakes, shove everything into the data lake and then shove it into this machine. It's going to do magical stuff for us. And that is sure that it's an AI, but that's not truly
no,
AI,
it's,
right?
It's like you say, it's a subcomponent. And it ties back to your thing about blockchain and this exchange of value. I mean, imagine when AIs are talking to AIs. They're leveraging each other. And so there's sort of AI / machine learning that might be occurring in a camera sensor that can detect, you know, animals, whatever it is. But now it's being leveraged by some other application that is also leveraging AI ML kind of capabilities. I mean, you know, it's got to be very much like the human brain. You know, your human brain is broken up into different sections that have different, if you want to say, skills, right? You have ones associated with vision, ones associated with hearing, areas associated with smelling. So that's the sensory. And then you do have memory, you know, and your memories. And then you've got, you know, areas that that control your physical body and how you move and what you do. And I think it's the same way. You know, these AIs will be interacting with each other, not that it's all coded into a single AI. The AlphaGo one is good at playing AlphaGo. You know, language processing AIs are good at language processing. But it's when they start to interact and they start to leverage each other's skills that it becomes really interesting.
Yeah. General purpose AI, I guess. And I think that's something that happens outside firewalls, right? I don't think it's going to happen inside of corporations. I think it's you and I, you know, doing stuff with our phones. And again, phones, people just look at phones. I mean, you know, the way we define phones today, I also think like we should change the name because it just totally underestimates what's in our hands, right? I mean, it's astonishing, the computing power, the memory.
Say this all the time. You know, I mean, people don't. I remember reading an article at one time that said, you know, if you could go back to, you know, somebody in, you know, even 100 years ago, and say, you know what, we're going to connect all the homes on Earth with copper wires, like people would have just thought you were insane, right? But that's really what the PSTN is, right? The whole phone network is that, right? Now, we've completely transcended that with wireless. And to say now, we're going to connect every human, no matter where they wander on Earth, wirelessly with each other. And the example I give that, you know, people and younger people just take for granted is right now, I could text message anyone else on Earth with a phone and they could reply to me, you know, in seconds as fast as they read and type. And that's just a given. Like we don't even think of that as marvelous. You know, I took a course a while back that talked about, you know, how to regain perspective. And they talked about try to live in wonder of the world around you. And I love that statement because they said, you know, when you're a kid, you see something and it's just like, wow, you know, there's that wonder. And as we get older, we take things for granted. We don't see that wonder. And now to think that, you know, you and I are sitting here talking and we're looking at each other what, halfway around the world from each other real time. And oh, yeah. It's just kind of like, yeah, we could do this tomorrow too. We could do this anytime we feel like, and it's no big deal. And it is. And like you say, the sensors, the compute power, you know, people don't look at that in wonder anymore. You know, I was thinking about this before getting on the call. You know, the fact that I now on a constant basis read about a new topic. I'm working a lot in mobile technologies and I want to learn about it. And I can just go pop open YouTube, do a search, find several presentations, watch them and become educated. Like it's almost like the Matrix. It's not quite jacked into my head yet. It's like I learned jiu-jitsu, but it's like that. You know, I can take this handset anywhere I have cell coverage, which is getting to be more and more of the total earth, and just access information, learn it, and interact with people all from something in my pocket.
That's incredible. You know, can I tell you a memory that I have too? I think you were the first person that got me onto ICQ. I think you set up my ICQ account for me. I still remember that. You came in, you were like, let me set it up for you. And I mean, for people that don't know ICQ, this was when ICQ was Mirabilis. That Israeli, the bunch of Israeli guys that built the first instant message. I mean, that would... Yeah, there we go. There we go. And then AOL made it AIM, but they kept ICQ. Like ICQ, there isn't an instant messaging tool in the world today that matches what ICQ could do in, what was that, late 90s?
Mid-90s. What year was that? I have to go back and look.
Mid-90s.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And you know, that even linked to the digital me thing, right? The various modes of communication.
Yeah.
And from your desktop, I mean, that was one that always got me, was that we had the directory at Novell, but didn't really leverage it to enhance people's day-to-day, you know, communications and things. But yeah, ICQ was, I mean, you're going to laugh, but the other night, just yesterday over the weekend, I'm cleaning my basement out and I'm hauling out. Like I had boxes of stuff that I haven't seen in decades. I just threw away a set of CDs of See You, See Me. You remember that? I bring it up with people. They're like, what? So CU was Cornell University. They had done it as a research project. And we were doing video conferencing over the internet in the mid-90s with CUME. And White Pine Software picked it up. And
White Pine.
And
that's right.
It's that same kind of thing where we were at such leading edge. But that, you know, that those steps in technology were there that far back. And crude on desktop machines, and now it's just you know, a given on in your hand all the time anywhere.
I almost feel that this is the way, like I keep coming back to Bitcoin, but this is when I explain Bitcoin to people, they always think about it in an exchange way, like, okay, I go to exchange fiat to Bitcoin, okay, but that's not Bitcoin. Bitcoin is actually like crypto wallet to crypto wallet, then you see the magic. But the problem is the crypto wallet is arcane. The UIs aren't great. But this is kind of what we would, when we were in the late 90s in the States, when we used to fly to Latin America, or we'd fly to wherever in the States, and we'd go sit in front of people and we'd show them the browser. I mean, people were like, it's okay. But to get it, like, you had to put a sound card in the box, and then you had to put a video driver. And then you had to install so many, and we were like, this is going to change the world. And everyone was like, no, it's not. And we were like, wait a minute, this is, and I think we're there again. And Bitcoin is kind of in that phase right now where people are completely underestimating it. They're not thinking about it. They're looking at it and then they're scoffing at it. And I think it's going to be just so big. But I want to transgress back to IoT, because I know you were with Twilio right?
So I joined Twilio in January of this year.
So you've been doing a lot of IoT. I mean, I went to your house even before the last time Lisa and I saw you. I was in your house. I think I did a house sitting session for you. And so people can't see this, but Scott actually is. You know what I'm going to do? Just keep it. Wait. Do that again. And I'm actually going to do a desktop squadcast screenshot. So people, there, I got it. And I got it. And what Scott's actually showing me is what's going on his desk at home. What is that, Scott? It looks like a Radio Shack in the
early 2000s. It's building IoT sensors. It's all my sort of things I'm hacking on right now. So some of those are Wi-Fi sensors that I've built, and now I'm evolving towards cellular. There's cellular modules. You know, I'm still constantly buying hardware and, you know, putting it together and writing firmware and software and systems to look at, you know, what are these things needed to build effective IoT solutions? And how do you drive the cost down, right? Because that's the one that's interesting. You know, I go back to the Novell days, Ray Norda, brilliant guy. And some of the conversations I had with him were just insane, you know, that I think of now. And, you know, one that he was really fixated on was, if you can decrease the cost of a technology, you will increase the market size. And to me, that was just brilliant business sense, right? So for IoT to grow, it has to continue to become less and less expensive for people to deploy it. And so, yeah, I'm now was doing a lot of Wi-Fi and doing LoRa and LoRaWAN. And now after joining Twilio, moved into the cellular realm. And it reminds me of a time, I don't know, do you remember when I was doing a lot with wearable computers and playing around with the wearables?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You were actually wearing some weird stuff at some time. There was some shit going on in your head that was like, it was not back then.
And I tell people that. Stories about, you know, going rollerblading with a wearable computer. And,
yes. Yes. I remember you roller skating or rollerblading.
And that was a realization on my part of where visual, like augmentation, I'm not convinced of AR, VR. Like, I think it's kind of cool, but, you know, the mediated reality or mixed reality that Microsoft is doing, I think has some legs and is moving in a direction. But it did teach me that audible augmentation is so underestimated. Like, to have your computer or your phone whisper things in your ear is so much less obtrusive and noticeable than you know, visual augmentation. So as an example, like,
wait. Yeah, this is fascinating. So, okay, yeah.
Audible augmentation.
Okay.
Right. So when I go on hikes, I hike every day. I try and get out and do about 3 to 5 miles, and I go up another mountain here, and I have my cell phone in my pocket and I have AirPods on. So I have an iPhone right now and I've got the AirPods on. I have to say, like, not as an Apple fan, the AirPods are probably the most amazing piece of hardware. My son bought them for me for my birthday, like last year or something. And they are stunning, the quality and the capabilities that have evolved. So I'm walking out on a hike and I've got my AirPods and I'm listening to music. They will now tone and then tell me if somebody texted me and say, Sam, your son, Sam just texted you, and it will read me the text. And I can now double tap and say reply, and it will say, what would you like to say? And I can just talk back and it'll say, okay, sent. And to me, that's this form of audible augmentation that it didn't interfere with my hike. It didn't interfere with me watching my feet, walking, doing anything. I'm listening to music. I get an audible notification of something. I can now interact very minimally with it and go right back to hiking. And none of that interfered with my sight, my vision, what I'm doing. It was purely audible. And I think about that as the future, right? Where, you know, if you think of being in a meeting and everybody's sitting there flipping their phones over, or they're glancing at their phones all the time because something popped up on it, versus you having your computer whisper in your ear something that is now usable information, you know, without that big break, separation. And, you know, and I'm not wearing big bulky goggles over my eyes or anything else.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think the future of kind of these, you know, Alexas and Google Homes and, you know, these sound prompted, voice prompted, it's kind of similar. Because you can ask something and it happens. It's almost in that magical way. Again, no UI, right? I love when something doesn't have a user interface or at least a GUI. Or as soon as something doesn't have a GUI and I can access the features of it, I think that's when it's magical.
So using the Echo, you know, I've got a couple of them. I've had it since almost when it came out, right? I had to get one and play with it. And there were some initial things I did with it that were interesting, but I found that it died off very quickly. I minimally use it. Okay. I do love to be able to voice ask it to play music. I love to be able to turn on and off my Sonos from it. I use timers all the time. So I don't know if you use timers with it, but you can say, you know, set a timer for X amount of time. And then I don't know if you knew with the Echo, there's an Echo clock. And you can buy the Echo clock. It's like $40. And so I have the Echo clock in my family room above my TV. So if I'm making dinner and I say, set a dinner timer for 20 minutes. Well, now on the clock, it has LEDs around the outside and it'll set one and you can watch the timer go down. So I now have this, you know, very smooth way that it's just in my, you know, environment without me having to think of how much time is left on the timer. And I don't even have to ask. I just glance up above the TV or look up on the wall and there's the timer. And you can set multiple timers, track multiple timers. So that's an interesting feature to me. I don't turn on and off lights a lot right now using voice. Like, I don't know why, but I think it's my old school training that entering a room, you know, my arm naturally extends at the right height. Just now I have home automation. And so I do have these switches that have four switches, but I know to touch which one based on the light that I'm going to turn on. You know, he probably does the same thing a lot. Now there are other things I do that are interesting. So I installed IP cameras all over outside my house and a couple inside. And I do use the sensors, motion sensors and things like that. And if I'm away from my house and I get a motion sensor or the front screen door was opened, I immediately whip out my phone and open up, you know, VLC or one of the apps to go view the streams from those cameras so I can see what's going on. But that, again, doesn't really use any of the voice control systems. Like, I still, I just haven't found that voice control app that is the killer app that has me use it all the time. You know, I do look up information. I ask questions sometimes. I'll ask about weather or time in another place. So there are some times it's handy.
At my house, I've used the Uber one quite often, but it depends on where I am. So it almost feels like the sound pickup needs to be more ubiquitous. Like, it's got to be in everything. Else, I still have to get there to tell it what to do. And I'd just rather flick my phone open and do it. And it's just as quick. In terms of making the devices cheaper and ubiquitous, where is IoT today? I mean, a lot of CEOs contact me and they go, tell me about AI. Tell me about, there's one other one, which I'm forgetting now, but the out of the three, IoT is the one that makes them sit up the most. Like, AI is interesting and they know they can kind of do, they need to do something there and they understand more or less. But the IoT one is the one where they can truly have an impact, theoretically speaking. And I'd like to get your view on in the short term. Like, I can do something about my building management system. And you know, at WeWork, it's incredible. The building management system and the sensors that they've placed in their buildings is probably the most unspoken technology platform of any company like it in the world. I mean, it's an incredible IoT reference. So they can do something there. They can do something with within their logistics areas. They can do something with product shipment. So where are you seeing corporations and enterprises doing things that are really useful and the price to value differential? It's just like the outcome, the ROI is just so big that it's just, it doesn't matter what the price point is. If we can do this, then, you know, we're going to have the value that we want. Where's the big IoT stuff happening now?
The biggest ones I'm seeing more currently are ones where the entire solution was built around IoT, not necessarily augmenting a business, right? So as an example would be telematics. Right. It blows my mind that, you know, I'm finding where pretty much every large truck on the road today is an IoT device, has a module in it that's probably communicating cellular real time with full streams of GPS information, potentially engine information and everything else. And it's going on all around us. There's actually mandatory law now in the United States and many other countries that has to be the fact. And so you have, you know, you're driving down the highway, but you don't think about the fact that all these trucks are connected. And the businesses doing it were built around that kind of connectivity, right? They were built to provide that service to truck fleets. And so they're managing these truck fleets and providing that solution. Another example is micromobility, right? All these scooters, all over the world that are being used are all cellular connected IoT devices. And you know, you see the scooters and yeah, you kind of know that you interact with it, purchase it, drive it. They can tell you where it is and stuff, but you don't think about the fact that, you know, that's hundreds of thousands of scooters worldwide that are all connected into this massive IoT solution. When you look at,
right,
you know, other business applications where people are starting to enhance business, I think building management or power energy management is probably a big one where people are wanting to know and, you know, control temperature or look at energy consumption of different devices for planning, things like that. You know, that becomes a valuable application. I'm trying to think of some other ones that I think there's a lot that are just silly. You know, that's the problem is I see a lot of cases where people are doing IoT just to do IoT. We saw some really interesting ones on factory floors. So you have a lot of big factories that have a lot of industrial automation. But when you look at small to medium size assembly lines and factories, a lot of them have no real automation. So being able to add IoT sensors on an assembly line to get product counts and understand the rates, like I've gone into about a half a dozen companies where they have whiteboards in the factory floor that's blocked off by the hour of the day, and somebody is doing manual counts at the end of a line and writing numbers on the whiteboard of how many product they produced each hour. That's one where now you're relying on humans, right, to do this work, whereas you could have been automating that. Yeah, it's been an interesting ride, you know, watching what people think they can do with IoT, and then those who have really tried to consider the ROI of IoT. You know, it's one thing to just do it versus are you really going to get your money back, you know, putting it into that IoT device?
Got it. So I want you to end on a philosophical point, right? I love the statement that you came up with is still to me, I mean, the internet is the developing nervous system of the human organism on Earth. And I love that. And you also allude to the human gut, and you actually allude to humanity actually being perhaps the microbiome of this overall system that's being developed. So just kind of end off with that, please. I want to hear that.
I once went to a series of seminars that were out at Stanford that a friend of mine was doing, John Smart, just amazing guy. And he was doing these presentations on the singularity, and he would do some, but he brought in just the world leaders in thought on singularity in the future. And, you know, they were those meetings where, you know, you get to hang out with just the most amazing people. You know, it's meeting Ray Kurzweil and Nick Bostrom and Stuart Brand and others, and getting to have these interesting conversations. And I remember this person did a presentation about what we really are as humans. And that is that gut bacteria conversation. Like, we don't think about the fact that humans evolved around what is now gut bacteria. That gut bacteria, you know, those bacteria were the initial life forms and eventually were incorporated in larger life forms, and then that evolved to become larger and larger, and eventually, you know, here we are. And we like to think of ourselves as, you know, autonomous humans doing our thing, but, you know, the presentation posited to think about, are we really just highly evolved gut bacteria carriers? Because what are we driven by? Well, during the day, you know, you have to eat, you have to drink. Why? Well, you got to feed your gut bacteria. And so what you're doing on a daily basis, yeah, you're doing all these other things, but in the end, you really are driven by this gut bacteria that is still ancient and kept alive. And that really got me thinking about these conversations of the singularity. And, you know, if we're these highly evolved gut bacteria containers that, you know, move around the planet, then the IoT is now allowing the internet to start to physically interact with the physical world. And it's this developing nervous system of the internet, of the next singularity. And this is another important thing from, if you talk to people about singularity, it's not that there's one, but that there have been a series and there will be a next one. But if that's the case, then, you know, my next thought was, well, you know, are we sort of the gut bacteria of the developing nervous system and the next singularity of then, you know, what's coming and being built by the internet. And this is why I don't have as much fear when people say, oh my gosh, is AI going to kill us? And is all this going to happen? It's like, well, that would be like us killing our gut bacteria. If we did it, we'd die. I think humans will be a fundamental part of whatever it is that's evolving around us, and it'll be a fundamental part of interacting with technology, but technology itself will begin to interact at a level that far exceeds, you know, human comprehension and capabilities.
That's it, man. I can't ask you to say more. I love it. Absolutely love it. Now, the big question is, when are you going to come to South Africa? When can I put you on a stage when it's COVID friendly?
I'm actually pretty flexible on that. I'd love to come down. We've talked about it for years, and now with some of the changes and stuff, it was fun. I mentioned that to Sam the other day. He goes, well, wait a minute, you got to do it when I can go too. I'm open for it. I would love to come down there. I'd love
to show you what the tech guys are doing down here. I almost feel like the USA plays around with a lot of tech. I feel like in Africa, the tech year actually has human impact. I mean, I met a couple of guys the other day and they showed me a mobile MRI machine, right? Because they're building it because his dad died because he couldn't have access to proper X-ray services. So he was like, I am going to study and I'm going to figure what an MRI machine is all about. And I'm going to build one that is as big as a shoebox. And I'm going to, so we've got that type of innovation happening here. We've got guys doing things with drones, with agriculture. That's off the charts. We've got people doing stuff with drones and healthcare. That's just because the human need is so immense. And so the technological innovation that we see, and people said the next 1 billion people are going to come from Africa in terms of being connected to the internet. That was exciting, but you know what's really cool? Is that 1 billion minds are being connected to AIs, right?
Yeah.
They're not just being connected. And they can augment all of that. And I think what will come from that will be fascinating. So I'd love for you to come down and come take a look at the stuff that's happening down there.
I'd love to. I'd really enjoy it.
Okay, Scott, I appreciate your time, buddy. And well, by the way, how's the weather there?
Spring here. So it's beautiful to me, but we've had like 3 days of rain and it was supposed to snow this morning. This morning it was 37 degrees. Now freezing is 32. It was supposed to snow. No way. And this is in June. And we just had 100 degree temperatures last week. So, you know, it's kind of fun to see the way the pattern shift. But, you know, to me, this is beautiful. I love this kind of weather.
Do you remember? Wait. I'm going to give you another memory. Remember when you and I went skiing in Park City and you were wearing jeans and there was some idiot that was like, no one skis in jeans. Remember that? And they like, they chased us off the thing. And then, but we went back up again.
Yeah. Do you remember I've done that in shorts even, you know, it's like, spring skiing here is beautiful. It's it really is quite the experience.
I went out, was skiing with a bunch of friends a few years ago and I never said that I could ski. So we went up and, you know, to see a black guy put on skis and like beat all the other Caucasian guys. They were quite shocked. And I actually thought the people that taught me how to ski was Scott Wilinski and Scott Lemon. I'll never forget that. One other memory, this is another one that just comes to mind now. Do you remember the time you, Scott Wilinski, and I drove up to Little Cottonwood Canyon? And I think we were going to, I forget which resort it was, Alta.
And?
We were going up to Alta.
Yes.
That's Alta, right? That's a ski resort. And we went up and I said, Scott, the robot's red. And the two of you turned to me and you went, what robot? And I went, no, there, can't you see the robot? And you were like, do you mean the traffic light? And I was like, yeah, okay, the traffic light. And you were like, oh my God. And then afterwards, you guys used to rip me. Sue Stafford, the traffic light's the robot. Green.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, no, those are good times.
Scott, good seeing you, man, bud. I hope to see you again soon, brother.
Yes, likewise.
You've been listening to another episode from the Solid Gold Podcast Studios.